Google shutting down part of its business, even better versions of Star Wars, and Verizon giving people back their money? All that and more on this week's Slongcast. Hello and welcome to this week's Slongcast, episode 16, for Wednesday, October 13th, 2010. I'm your host, Kevin Slonka, and with me as always is Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Hey, how's it going?
It is going well, but you know that because we just got done eating dinner at the Southside.
Yes, it was very good. Tasty.
Yes, Comey Tacos. Mm. If you live anywhere near Johnstown, you need to go there and get their Comey Tacos. Very good. Okay, so let's get... Got a drink. So let's get right into it. So this first article, it's a sad day. I mean, it really is a sad day for those people with non-smartphones. Google has shut down their 411 service. Have you ever used it?
Never.
Yeah, I haven't either. But that's best because I've had a smartphone for the past 5-6 years, so I've never needed it. But, you know, those people who know what 411 is... This is very similar. If you call normal 411, generally you get charged a fee in the dollars. Like, it's not just a 50-cent fee. It's like a dollar, you know, multiple dollar fee to call normal 411. Well, Google came out with their own 411. It was free, and, you know, everything was voice activated.
Except it was 1-800-GOOG-411.
Yeah, so you can't just stop 411. You have to know
their
number. It's
like, oh, what the hell's that number again?
Right. It's not just 411.
Yeah.
But, I still have a friend who still doesn't have a smartphone, and he always used Google 411 to look up stuff on his dumb phone while he was out and about, and this really hits him. So I'm just wondering how bad it hits people who don't have smartphones.
My guess is not too terribly bad because they're shutting it down.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Did they say why? Like,
well, it's probably a little tough to advertise, you know, via this phone deployment method. Like, if they send you, like, their other service, the 466-453 number that you text to, if you send something to that, you know, maybe they could, like, you know, put a little link to an advertisement on the back of it, or, like, just say, like, sponsored by, you know, Menin or something.
By Menin.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, something... They could somehow attach an advertisement to it. But this method, I mean, I guess unless they do like on hold advertisements.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of Slidial?
No.
So it's a really cool thing that lets you dial right into people's voicemail boxes. So you don't have to talk to them. You can just leave them a voicemail on their cell phone.
How does that work?
There's some special code. You know, all cell phone carriers have this. Just like, you know, at work, if you were to dial somebody's number, you can just hit 1 and go straight to their voicemail. Well, cell phones have the same thing, and this company does it for you. But they do pre-roll ads. You dial in, you have to listen to an ad, and then you can dial the person's phone number and be connected to their mailbox. Hmm. So I wonder if, you know, Google just couldn't make money on this or what the deal was. But it seemed like a very useful service. Maybe what you said earlier, a lot of people just couldn't remember the number and therefore didn't use it.
Yeah, I've never used it, not once.
Yeah, I don't know. So I know there are a few people out there who are very sad that it's gone, but I'm with you. I don't think most people care or even knew about it. But sticking with Google, they've been doing something that most people might think is a little weird and maybe a little dangerous, and that is they have automated cars out on the road with normal people. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, actually, I saw the article linked somewhere else a couple days ago, and it's pretty interesting. I think this is technology's answer to texting while driving. This is something that could really revolutionize vehicle safety. Not that I am of the opinion that texting while driving has at all raised the accident rate of injury rate in cars. The numbers from the National Highway Transportation Administration totally refute any argument of that. But nonetheless, it may make people feel safer.
Yeah. And that's, you know, they're making a strong point to say that we are not trying to make cars that drive themselves. the whole purpose of this project is just to make driving safer.
Yeah.
So if you happen to veer into a lane, your car knows it and it corrects.
Yeah.
And what Google's been doing is they've actually been having the cars drive themselves. Right. So it's really awesome.
I'd like to have cars drive themselves.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Like Minority Report, you just hop in and bam.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everybody wants a, like, if you could choose to just have a chauffeur take you anywhere, like, at your command, you know, and you didn't have to pay them anything.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
I mean, you know, plus you, like, you get to pick the car that you wanted it to use it in. And, you know, they totally need to do this. I'd say spend more money on it, like, make it perfect and, you know, help. Maybe it'll help solve traffic problems because all the cars can coordinate and, like.
That's the key. If all the cars could talk to one another. I mean, this was something I saw. Discovery Channel always runs those like future thing episodes, and they did one on the car where the cars all talk to each other. They can navigate around accidents and do things. So if Google can make that part work with the automated driving, that would be amazing.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
Yeah, so those of you in California, don't be afraid when you see a car with nobody in the driver's seat, only the passenger seat.
Yeah.
They're actually safe. Google knows what they're doing. But Google has also done one more thing. Well, they've done many things that are newsworthy, but another thing based in the internet that is newsworthy, and that is they think that they have a successor to the JPEG image format known as WebP. Now, we talked about WebM before being their video codec that they wanted to use with HTML5 to try to get rid of Flash, and now they have WebP for images. I don't know much about WebP. Do you?
Not a whole lot. They say it's pronounced Weppy.
Yeah, Weppy.
Weppy.
Whatever.
I don't like that. Weppy.
That's a stupid name.
It is stupid. I think I know why Google may be doing this, honestly.
What's your opinion here?
They've stated that their goal here is to make the images load faster and use less bandwidth. My guess is that when Google spends a lot of money on bandwidth, I'd imagine.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
And a lot of that is the searching, but if you think about it, the search results, actually, it's pretty low bandwidth. I mean, it's like you send a text query, and they send you like a list of text links back.
Yeah, basically. Especially on their page, it's very low bandwidth.
Right, very low bandwidth. But they've got to crawl all those pages. So my guess is that, now, I'm sure there's ways to avoid the images loading, but I don't know that they could do that in all instances.
Well, I'm going to disagree there. I think they can, just because I know that, like, all Unix systems come with a utility called wget. And if you just wget an HTML page, it just downloads the actual HTML. You know, no images, no nothing. It's just code. So maybe that's what they're doing so that they don't have to worry about images and videos.
Maybe.
I don't know. So point, counterpoint, I just kind of rained on your parade.
Yeah, it probably doesn't. You're probably right. And then plus, I mean, and there's probably ways to block it even in like normal, like,
yeah,
in other uses. But yeah. I was just thinking, it's got to be of some benefit to them.
Yeah, I mean, they're a search company, so pretty much everything they do has some benefit in the search realm.
Yeah.
I don't think this is going to work. I think this is another JPEG 2000. You know, the reason JPEG...
Or like PNG.
Well, even PNG is good. I mean, it hasn't replaced JPEG, but it has its part, and a lot of people use it. But like, nobody uses JPEG 2000 because it was meant to replace JPEG, the image standard.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, you need all still cameras to convert to that. You need all web pages to convert to that. You need all operating systems to natively support it. Like, that's a big deal.
Well, I don't know if you need all that stuff to support it. You just need like good standards that allow anyone to use whatever graphic format they want. And I'm wondering if HTML5 would somehow support this natively.
Oh, so some sort of inside, like, the rendering engine natively, yeah, do that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it does or not, but
that's a good point. Whether they're just trying to make WebP for internet images, or whether they're trying to replace JPEG on digital cameras and all other media.
I don't think it's. I think it's probably just for web pages. That's why they called it WebP.
That is a good point. Web is in the name.
You know, point, counterpoint.
Maybe I should read the articles a little better. So this next article from PCMag.com. Is very disturbing, and you all know, all you in listener land, that anytime we say the words very disturbing, we're talking about Facebook.
Yep.
And Facebook has introduced a new groups function. Now, they've always had groups, but what they're doing now, or the way groups work now, is that your friends can sign you up for groups without you knowing. You don't get to approve or deny. And what some people have done is they've went out and added their friends to the NAMBLA group.
Yeah.
So very not cool, because this also shows up in your public timeline.
Yeah.
So all of your other friends see that you joined this group, even though you didn't. Has anyone done this to you?
No, thank goodness. Yeah, this is definitely a problem, because there's people's, some people's jobs that would probably be,
exactly,
you know, I guess, what do you call it?
In jeopardy?
In jeopardy, yeah. If something like this happened and it got out. I don't know. I haven't checked myself, but I imagine there's probably some setting somewhere in their privacy controls that you can turn off to not allow people to do this.
There is. I believe that Groups is like an app now, so you can remove the app.
Or like restrict its abilities or something.
There's no restriction. That's the funny thing. You can't like put a restriction on it that says, make me approve or deny.
Yeah.
You know, it's either all or nothing.
Yeah, I didn't like their answer either. They're like, oh, well, just, you know, don't have friends on Facebook to do that. Like, if you don't trust them, it's like, oh, have you guys ever heard of, like, you know, being vindictive? Like, maybe, like, somebody just, like, doesn't like you anymore, or, like, thinks that you did something wrong to them, and or maybe you did do something wrong to them, but doesn't, like, it's not like, you know, I don't know. It doesn't mean that they can add you to a group of like some illegal activity just because you wronged them.
Right. I mean, just because people are my friends, and I mean real friends, people I know and talk to, that doesn't mean I trust them. I mean, really, like, would you trust me to have full control over your Facebook account?
No.
Right.
Yeah.
Nobody would do that. So why would you give any of your friends control to add you to groups? Like, their answer was just ridiculous.
Yeah, my advice to them is to change this and get rid of the person that gave that answer.
Yeah, really. It was probably Mark Zuckerberg who passed it down to their PR person to spill to the world.
Exactly.
But, you know, we always rip on Facebook, but they are doing one thing good. I haven't seen it on my profile yet, but supposedly it's being rolled out that you can now export all of your data that you have put into Facebook. Your photos, your posts, other people's photos that you have been tagged in, literally all of your information can now be downloaded to a zip file and you have it. So it's kind of a backup. If a new social network comes out, you might be able to import, you know, export and import all your stuff. Have you seen this on your profile?
I haven't. I like the idea though.
Yeah, I definitely do. And it's really cool how they did it. It's not just a dump, you know, a database dump. If you open the zip file, there's an HTML page, and when you open it, it's kind of like mini Facebook. Like, you can browse it as if it were Facebook and click on your photos and click on your wall, so even the non-technical people can see all their stuff without having to sift through 1,000 JPEGs. And
that's cool.
So yeah, that is pretty cool. What I'm wondering, why? Do you have any idea why they would do this? Like, this doesn't benefit them.
I don't know. Well, they should make a new extension called PFF, Portable Facebook Format.
PFF. That's good, though. Yeah. But, yeah, I just...
Yeah, I don't know why. I'm wondering if there's not some sort of litigation somewhere along the way that they've, like, had to, like, answer privacy concerns or ownership concerns or I don't know.
Could be some sort of, you know, antitrust like they did with Microsoft. You're the only OS. You can't do this. Maybe some lawsuit was brought against Facebook. You're the quote unquote only social network. So you have to give people this ability. I don't know. But if you want to check it out, you know, the article we have is on Computer World. But if you go to YouTube, you can do a search and it's them explaining how this works. So you could actually go and see what they have to say about it. And hopefully you'll see it soon. You know, hopefully you'll be able to log into your Facebook profile and actually download all of your data. So it'll be an option in your settings if you have it. I'm looking forward to that.
I wonder how big it is.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's like, we are now downloading your personal information. Please wait. The download is 25 gigabytes.
Right. I mean, I can only imagine. I know that they shrink all of your images, and they shrink and compress. So I don't think images. I mean, if you're in a lot of images, you know, some people I see are tagged in thousands of images. So yeah, that's going to be a lot.
Yep.
Wow. Hope you all have broadband, not just dial-up. So moving along, we see something that if you've been paying attention to browser shares, you've seen this trend for quite a while, but this is kind of a milestone because for the first time, Internet Explorer's worldwide market fell below 50%. They are now, or at least as of October 5th, down to 49.87%. So before I say any more about this, what do you think about this, Ryan?
I think it's kind of a sign of the times with Chrome, you know, and I think Chrome, they said, you know, gained market share. Chrome's a great browser. It's fast. It's light. It's HTML5 compliant. And, you know, Google's been pretty, I mean, the crazy thing is it's like only been a year since version one or like maybe a year and a half. It's kind of scary. Now we're on like version 5 or 6.
Yeah, what was the article? We talked about it a couple weeks ago that they're going to come out with like a new major version every couple months or something. Like yeah. They're really going to start cranking out the features soon.
I don't recall myself, but it's definitely, you know, it's impressive that they've grown so much and what they're able to release in the time frame they do.
Right. Yeah. So if you definitely want to be on the bleeding edge of web browsing, you know, use Chrome because they're going to be making major updates.
But you know, in terms of IE, I think what it says is that IE9 better be pretty good, and from a lot of accounts, it is. I downloaded the beta myself, and I think it's impressive.
What if you remember what changes from IE8? Like, what big things have they done?
The whole layout is like really different.
So they changed it again.
Yeah, I mean, it's honestly even more like it's even more minimalistic than Chrome, if you can believe that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very very like stripped down. It's fast. I had some problems with the beta. One of their big features in it is the hardware acceleration, which currently I don't think any other browser has, at least for Windows. And I don't even know if like they have that on Mac or not.
I don't know.
In Safari, but the hardware acceleration allows the OS to serve up its like video card APIs and that sort of stuff to the browser.
Right.
So that they can use it to do 3D rendering and other, you know, acceleration tasks. It's really, it's probably the future of browsers because of all browsers, because they're doing more and more applications inside the browser. And then I'd say the other biggest change, is that it supports HTML5. I think I ran the ACID3 test on it, and it got like a 95 out of 100 on
that. That's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, Chrome gets like 100.
Right.
But it's still a beta, and there's a couple things everyone knows that they don't support yet in the HTML5. There was a PDF that circulated the internet probably about 2 months ago comparing all the different browsers, and they had IE9 on there even though it wasn't released yet, with what it supported is in HTML5 and what it didn't. And there was a couple things it didn't, but overall I liked it. Mine was a little buggy with the hardware acceleration. I had to turn that off. And even when I did it, it had messed with some like graphic, displays in Windows Arrow.
Okay.
Overall I liked it. I think once the full version comes out, I'll download it again and use it, or give it a shot.
Right.
So,
right. Yeah. That's one of the reasons why I don't like Google Chrome that much, is because of the minimalistic look. You know, I guess that's just the first thing that turned me off was the layout. So I'll probably, you know, not give IE that good of a try if it's similar to Google Chrome.
See, I like the scaled down part of it because it loads faster. The other thing that I'm finding more and more is that screens, laptop screens or computer screens have tended to get, they've gotten wider, but not as tall. And we're sort of like losing vertical resolution.
Yeah, I don't like that laptop manufacturers are putting out 1080 displays.
Right. You know, my display is, you know, 1920 by 1080, which 1080 is, it's typically enough vertical resolution for me, but I would actually prefer like a probably 1900 by 1200 display.
That's my laptop that I'm using right now is 1920 by 1200. And mm-hmm. I love that. You know, that's, you can fit a lot on the screen.
Yeah. But I think that, you know, because that trend is to go wider, that the minimalistic like design is good because it reduces the top and bottom. They've tried to reduce the top and bottom of the window, which gives you more space for your actual web content.
Cause right.
I go to some web pages on certain screens, and once you get all the ad banners off the top, like you have to scroll down like two pages to get to the actual content.
Right.
And it's probably good for marketing and advertising and all that stuff, but it's not good for the content. So I'm all for this like minimalistic design. I think sometimes the UIs are just way too cluttered to begin with.
Yeah, so I'm interested to see whenever IE9 starts getting pushed out by Windows updates, if their share starts picking up again, if it's that big of a deal that people start using it.
Yeah, I need to like do some research into the market share for Internet Explorer. Like that was the they gave the worldwide share.
Right.
I think like one thing is like the corporate share is still well over 90% for IE. And I think that's going to hang around as long as Windows does, because it's just they have more control over the browser because it's more integrated with Windows.
Right.
So I think, you know, IE9 probably won't have much of an impact on the market share for corporate. It'll probably stay the same. And I think for home users, you'll probably see a lot of people that had switched to Firefox or maybe Chrome start to give IE a chance again. I don't think it's going to affect Apple at all. I mean, even if they do release IE for Apple, which I don't know right. if they are or not.
Yeah, the last one I remember is IE6, maybe. Mm. Like, that was a long time ago. Yeah, either way, we'll see what happens whenever it comes out. So moving on, we know that, you know, Dish has their DVR and their on-demand. Your cable service has their DVR and on-demand. But a company now is coming out with their way to give you a television experience. And it's not a company you would expect. Google. They are introducing Google TV. And I am hoping that this is going to be awesome, because Google is the best search company, so they know how to find stuff. So what I'm hoping is that you have your Google TV appliance, and you know it does a DVR, so you can record stuff, you can get your stuff over the air or via Dish or cable, whatever you have, but that you can also use Google's awesome search to go find data on demand. So if I missed the most recent episode of Glee, I would be able to bring up Google TV's search box, type in Glee, hit enter, it'll scour the internet and find me that episode. That would be awesome. Would you ever consider switching to, or not, maybe not switching, but adding a Google TV device to your home theater?
I honestly, I'd have to give it a try to see. I think I like the idea of being able to search and find things. But content like distribution online, especially TV content, it's really fragmented right now. They use a lot of like flash based video, which may or may not work, but they, like Hulu and these other sites, have put like, you know, constraints over what you can view directly.
Right.
And you know, the way I look at it is just like they should, in my opinion, just embed ads, you know, embed ads in the streams.
Oh.
You know, well, I mean, you got to pay for the content. I mean, if you want Glee to be on TV, it's got to make money. It's got to at least pay for itself.
Yeah, I would prefer like pre-roll and post-roll.
Well, that's fine.
Rather than interrupting.
I can't argue with that too much. Or, you know, or maybe it's a pay-based service. But
and that's one thing they're looking at too, is having apps. So you might buy the HBO app for your Google TV device and then get it, you know, content that way. Pay $10 a month for the HBO app.
Well, that could work. I mean, I think they may find that that people were willing to pay for specific channels, you know, and sort of like a a la carte type.
And I think that is the case. I think if people were given the opportunity to either pay and get something now or go figure out how to steal it, more than likely people were going to pay to get the stuff legally,
right,
if they have the option.
Well, the one argument that the cable companies have made for years, and I'm not sure if I totally agree or not, or I don't really have the data to even understand it, but they say that the demand for a lot of the channels is actually very low, and that if they didn't package them into a bundle, that no one would buy the other channels, and those channels wouldn't even survive.
I'm going to say that's probably 100% true.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the interesting thing is there was a link on Reddit a couple weeks ago or days ago that to a price schedule of what the cable companies pay per prescriber, or like what the breakdown of your bill is and the percentage that goes to each channel. And like the channels that were like the most expensive were like ESPN, Fox Sports, stuff like that, the sports channels.
Right.
They were like $4 or $5 per subscriber of their bill, where the rest of the channels were like fractions of a dollar or less. Like some of them were like 30 cents, 40 cents. So there's a couple that were like a buck.
Yeah, I know there are a lot of channels that I have that I just don't watch.
Right.
I might have 6 or 7 channels that I like to watch stuff on.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't care. What do you think, you know, should Google TV come out and all this stuff work? What do you think about just bandwidth? Like, this is going to take lots of your internet bandwidth to make this happen.
Well, I mean, no more than it would watching Hulu.
What I'm thinking is, if you have this on TV, you're going to watch it a lot more. I think that a lot of people don't watch things like Hulu, or they do, but they don't watch it a lot just because it's a small screen on their laptop. But if you have it available via remote on your TV, you might do it a lot more.
It could be. I mean, it definitely, you might stream video more often.
Right.
And you might start to break through some caps, but most of the residential internet, you know, the wireline internet, it's the caps are pretty high. It'd be pretty hard to break it, you know, even with an HD video stream going. Like,
right.
I mean, no one's going to watch it 24 hours a day.
That is true.
And I'd say if you average, 4 hours of TV on, like, I don't know, 5 days a week, or say 20 hours of TV a week. I mean, you go and do the math on what like a 20 megabit stream. Well, you're not even going to get 20 megabits.
No, you're not going to get that high.
Yeah. So, I mean, figure most people's DSL connections are 3-4 megabits.
I'd say 3 is probably the highest, at least around here.
Yeah. So, you know, figure it out. I don't think you would hit and run into too many caps.
Yeah. If we do, I think Senator Stevens would have something to say about that.
The internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes. And if you don't understand, those tubes can be filled. And if they're filled, when you put your message in, it gets in line. It's going to be delayed by anyone that puts into that tube enormous amounts of material. Enormous amounts of material.
I had to play that. I mean, that's just too funny to not play. I don't think that's going to happen that way. That people start watching all of this stuff and all of a sudden our emails get, you know, in line and people don't get our emails for days at a time. But I do think bandwidth might be a problem for those people, you know, with dial-up. They're obviously not going to be able to use Google TV. For those people who bought the lesser DSL, you know, the 512 or the 1 megabit, they're probably not going to be able to watch Google TV or data through Google TV. So, yeah, New York, San Francisco, this is going to be awesome. Places around here, half and half. Some people can, some people can't.
I just doing some quick math. With a 3 megabit connection, 3 megabit per second connection, it works out to, if I did my math right, about 1.3 gigabyte, a little less than 1.3 gigabytes per hour.
Wow, so 5 gigabytes a day. So 25 gigabytes a week.
Yeah. So that, probably about 100 a month. I think the caps are in like the, aren't the caps in like the 200
region? 200, 250.
Yeah. So I still think you'd be hard pressed to totally like annihilate a 3 megabit connections cap, but right. It definitely would go, I mean, if you're already near the limit, you might help it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm very excited. I hope this comes out. I hope it's not expensive. I hope they don't screw it up with ads. You know, if there's one thing I hate, it's watching a YouTube clip and seeing a lower third pop up over top of my video with an ad. I hope Google doesn't go that route. But let's keep talking about video, and this might make everybody mad that George Lucas is working on converting the entire Star Wars saga to 3D.
Really?
I mean, really. I know anyone who has been to the theater and watched a movie in 3D that wasn't made in 3D knows that it sucks. Like, the only 3D videos, movies that are good are ones that were either shot on 3D cameras or animated movies that were made for 3D. You mm-hmm. can't just go back after the fact and convert it. It looks bad.
Yeah, well, part of what they might be doing is re-rendering the, like, the special effects scenes.
So you get things shooting at you.
Yeah, and like, you know, the big ships that are, they're models anyways. So right. It's just, you know, a matter of turning them into, like, digital things and rendering two views.
Yeah, I'm worried.
I don't know. I'm not so much worried because it's not originally shot in 3D. I'm worried because I still don't think that 3D is going to be this huge thing. Like, you know, maybe I'm like, I don't know. Maybe I'm sound like the guy that called the internet a fad 10 years ago, but I think 3D is a fad. I really do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been around for a long time in many varieties, and, you know, I've seen some stuff with, like, the polarized glasses, and it's cool, but it's still not like crazy awesome. It's not like blow your mind amazing.
Yeah, see, I'm not quite to that point, but I wish, and I wrote an article about it, you know, I wish that everything was 3D now. Everything was made in 3D. I went and saw How to Train Your Dragon in IMAX 3D.
Mm-hmm.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
Like, a movie that was made for 3D, and it wasn't the stupid red-blue 3D. It was polarized glasses. And that, you felt like you were in the middle of the movie and things were happening around you. Like I said, I will never watch anything in 2D again, but, you know, obviously I have to because nothing is in 3D anymore. But I wish it would take over. You know, I really wish it would. I like it that much. But yeah, people were already mad whenever they came out with the Star Wars DVDs and they put in Anakin Skywalker into that fire scene. They're like, no, you can't change the original movies. And now they're changing the original movies again. So expect to see a lot of controversy in the media about this whenever they start to release it.
Yeah, the thing that I think they run a risk of is turning Star Wars into a meme. Like, it's getting to the point where it's like, oh, it's never going to die. You know, in like 2,000 years, they'll be like, you know, whatever
Missile new... Jar Jar Binks!
Yeah, whatever advanced technology that we have then, they'll be converting it into, like, you know, it's one thing to just, like, you know, oh, it's on VHS and now it's on DVD and now it's on Blu-ray and fine. Right. But, like,
hey, we have brain implants. Oh, let's convert Star Wars.
Yeah, like, to convert it, like, to make it different, you know, like, then just move the format to the next generation or just rescan the original films at a higher resolution. Those to me are reasonable, but to, like, change the content is what bought it. I mean, I'm not one of these Star Wars, like, diehard, like, oh, don't touch Star Wars.
Right.
But, and I could really care less if they release the originals on DVD. Like, if they do, maybe I'll buy them.
See, I kind of wish they would, just because whenever I watch the newer ones, you can tell that all the special effects have been redone, and you just see it, and it looks so out of place. You know, you think of that while you're watching the movie, you're like, oh, that doesn't look good. You know, I just don't want to think that while I'm watching a movie.
I agree with you. The argument that I've heard and that I kind of agree with is that if you watch the new ones, the effects kind of look out of place in some areas, and that now they all kind of, like, at least flow together. Where, like, had you taken the originals and put them right up against the episodes 1, 2, and 3, it just would, like, look so weird. Without the, like, sort of the bumpers on either end to kind of, like, tie them together.
Right.
But I agree. I just think they should just leave them alone.
Yeah. And speaking of 3D, everybody has been complaining about the 3D glasses. Nobody wants to wear glasses, especially if you buy one of those TVs that you need the $150 3D glasses and you need a pair for every person in your house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Toshiba is coming out with a television, a 3D television, that they say you don't need glasses. Have you heard about this before? No glasses 3D?
Well, I've heard of a few TVs that I don't know if they were just, like, samples, engineering samples, where they put, like, polarized glass in front of the TV, but you don't need, like, certain viewing angles it doesn't work at.
That's exactly what this is.
Oh, okay.
You have, like, 5 places in your living room that you can sit for the 3D effect to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, crap.
Yeah. This is the other part of 3D. Like is like you mentioned the glasses. Like it's like, oh, I don't want to wear glasses when I'm watching TV. It's like, you know, it's why I got contacts in the first place. I don't have to wear glasses at all.
Right.
And if it doesn't work, like if they make this, if they can make like holograms, like they had in like Star Wars, like
that would be awesome.
Like holograms. Like yeah. If you can like do that, you know, then I'll start giving you some cred. But this like fake your eyes into thinking it's 3D when it's really not 3D. It's, you know, I mean, it doesn't, our eyes don't even like, we don't even really, I think if I remember reading correctly, we don't even actually see 3D. It's completely like 3D imaging is a complete like manifestation in our brain.
Right. It's a mind trick.
Right. Like we have two slightly different views on reality. And we can like our brain can make that into 3D,
right?
You know, because of our two eyes. But it's like I don't understand why people are trying to, you know, make it seem like it's 3D. Like I'm fine with motion pictures. Like,
yeah, I'm happy I can watch movies. That is awesome.
Yeah, to be quite honest, I'm fine with a still picture. Like, I think some of the best art ever made are still photographs. You know,
and not to get too far off topic, I just want to say that I hate certain people who are saying that still photography is going away and photographers will have to be video photographers and you will get your stills by extracting frames from video.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
No, I hate those people. Like, they should just be set on fire.
Yeah, you'd need... You need to even do that, you need really, really, really good cameras.
You would need RED cameras, you know, that are what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know.
8K.
Oh, 8K.
4K or 8K cameras to get anywhere close to the megapixel size of still cameras to start with.
That's just in a megapixel aspect.
That's a size.
But like when it comes to, what a lot of people don't realize is like with film video camera, like film cameras.
Real film.
Yeah, they shoot at 30 frames a second. Well, even like, you know, like your HD Handycam, you shoot your kid's soccer game in, it shoots at like 30 frames a second. And to do that, that means that their longest exposure time you can have is 1/30th of a second. Any longer, and it's not going to work. So you have to have really high performing cameras to get higher frame rates that you would need for certain type, or I'm sorry, it's lower. If you wanted to do something lower to get like a certain effect with light.
Right. Let a lot of light in.
Yeah. It's, you're totally limited by that camera. So I think that we're a long way off before that's even possible. To be quite honest, I don't even like shooting video. Like, it's not something I like to do. I'm not going to sit there with the camera. It's like when I have, you know, and stay in one spot and it's always on. There's a lot more logistics surrounding video shoots than there are photo shoots.
Yeah, I bought my Canon 5D Mark II because it shoots 1080p video. Thinking I would get into video a lot more. I've had it for about a year and I haven't gotten into video that much. Yeah. I've recorded a couple things, but I still take still pictures.
Yeah, I mean, those features are really amazing because the quality of video that it can shoot and the fact that it works like the way a movie camera would.
Right.
Not a video camera, but a movie camera, in that you have like control over focus and that sort of stuff.
Right, depth of field and
depth of, yeah. Right, you can do that all on the fly, which you can't, you know, which is something they do on in movies, you know, on film.
Right. Something they don't let you do on handycams or anything like that.
Exactly.
Yeah, so to those people who are saying that, go away. Please stop.
Yeah.
So before we go on, I would now like to take this time to thank our sponsor for this week.
AT&T capping your bandwidth? Verizon only offering you phones from $19.99? You need the Sloancaster 5G from TracFone! No more burdening contracts from T-Mobile. With 5G, you get blazing fast data. It's one more G than Sprint. The Sloancaster 5G from TracFone. It's not a smartphone. It's a smarter phone.
No release date schedule, some restrictions apply. See site for details. So if you're looking for a new phone, definitely get out there and buy the new Sloancaster 5G from TracFone.
Yeah, that sounds interesting.
I think I might get rid of my iPhone.
Yes.
So let's move on to a couple security stories. There were a lot of security stories in the past couple weeks, but I tried to pick out just a couple that seemed very important. So this first one is another warning for all of you out there using the internet. Now, you all know that, or you better know, that whenever you get links and you hover over them and you see them in the status bar, what spammers have done for the longest time is they put something like google.com at the leftmost part of the link, but then they still do dot blah 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 dot blah 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 dot blah blah blah, make it really long so it scrolls off the screen, and the actual domain is some hacked domain that's going to download crap to you. Well, now what they're doing, instead of these super long URLs to trick you, is they're using invisible characters in the URLs. So you might actually get a link that your browser displays to you as google.com, but in reality, it might be google.com. It's what's known as the shy character, and it's normally used for line breaks. If a word is broken up over multiple lines, that is the hyphen that is used, the shy character. And it's that character because it's invisible and it doesn't get printed out, but browsers don't render it. So
some don't.
Some don't, yeah. So they're using that. It's in the domain, but when most browsers show it to you, you don't see it. So you think you're going to a real site, and this will really trick people. I mean, have you ever encountered this?
No, I haven't. I wonder if they could just fix this by...
Yeah, just make an update to the web browsers.
Well, right? I was going to say just like change the standard for URLs and don't allow the shy character in URLs.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that fix it?
That would. I don't know what that would take, you know, because that would require a patch to the DNS servers on every system that runs the internet.
Yeah.
So, you know, all bind, all Microsoft DNS... All any other...
Well, I think no one would be mad if they just retroactively said, okay, anybody that registered an address with an invisible character, we're deleting it.
Yeah, because nobody does that for real.
Right, A. And then B, just patch the root servers, and then...
Or just, you know, make...
Then just don't allow anyone to register that.
Right, they might not even have to patch anything. They just make the process so you can't submit for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Just change the network solution submit page
right.
to not accept the shy character.
Right. Yeah, this is scary, though. I mean, hackers are now finding ways to make things literally invisible that you, even if you're the smartest person in the world, cannot detect.
I just don't get the spammers. Like, there has never been an industry in all of mankind that was so devoted to making money from tricking you. Like, I'm serious. Like, I just don't get it. Like, I don't understand. It's just, it seems like there's, like, just some negative force in the universe that's allowing these people to survive.
It's the dark side.
It must be.
We need the Jedi's
like,
to come.
I've seen people run the numbers on like how they're profitable. You know, there's virtually no money spent on the infrastructure and the setup and all this other stuff. And then they just need like a couple people to click, like a couple stupid people to click on the damn link. Or
right. Well, let's talk about that for a second. Infrastructure, there is none because they utilize zombie networks and botnets that other people have already taken over, or maybe they've taken over. So their infrastructure is billions of computers like us that are already out on the internet, and they send out gajillions of emails, and like you just said, all they need are three people to click on them, and they've made money.
Yeah.
Like, it is the easiest thing to make money on if you don't get caught. You know, if you get caught, you're going to jail, but, you know, if you're good at it...
Well, some countries, it's probably not even illegal, so...
That is true. That's why most spammers come from, like, Romania and Russia and China.
Tuvalu. What's it, .tv?
TV, yeah. The island that's sinking. You remember when we talked about that before, people were concerned that the .tv top-level domain was going to go away soon because the island was going to disappear underwater.
Well, didn't they recently change top-level domain so you can have like really anything you want as a top-level domain?
Yeah, I mean, you always could. They just, like we were talking about before, didn't let you register them. So the systems would always allow dot anything you wanted, but the web pages didn't. But yeah, you can have like, I don't know, dot Kevin now if you wanted it.
Right.
Yeah. So speaking of botnets, this is something that is... Kind of makes me mad. I say that a lot. I think I've said that like 12 times so far this show.
At least.
But now what Comcast is doing, if they determine that your machine is part of a botnet, if you've been compromised, they will put an overlay, a layer into your web browser on whatever web page you're viewing, saying, you know, Comcast server notice, we've detected that your computer has been hacked. You know, please click go to the antivirus center to get it fixed. Now, you might think, why is that bad? That's kind of cool. They're letting you know that you have something on your machine that you might not have otherwise known you had. So that's cool. I don't like the way they're doing it. They're injecting HTML. They are opening up your packets to whatever web page you're browsing and injecting their own code into your packets to get this to display inside of your web browser. That is the only way this can happen the way they're doing it. It is showing up as part of the web page that you are currently browsing. That is what bothers me.
Yeah, I wonder, because I think the example they have shown, it's hard to see, but...
That example, it's an overlay over top of their own web page, comcast.net. So it's,
yeah, right. So like, if they did it on their own web page, like, I don't know, like if most Comcast customers, like when they get the internet, well, and really any ISP, it installs like, you know, some software and it makes your homepage like comcast.net,
right,
and you
right.
get your email and blah blah blah. But I wonder, like, if they were just doing it on their own pages or for people who had the Comcast toolbar installed or whatever, I would be okay with that. I do think it's a little bit shady that they're doing it to all web pages if they actually are doing that.
Yeah, I'm trying to read the article real
quick. It does say
to see.
All. It says whichever, you know, whatever's, well, it says whatever's displayed in the browser.
Yeah, whatever page. Yeah, and that's what kills me. Like, really? Is that even legal? Like, can they just open up people's packets and start injecting their own stuff into it?
Well, I mean, we don't have net neutrality right now.
True.
So, I mean, they're allowed to do whatever they want. It's their network.
Yeah.
You know, I think, though, the intent of this is very good.
I do agree.
So while it's a little bit unscrupulous, I wouldn't want them to see them use this for like advertising or something.
Well think
and
of
if
it
they
this...
do, like, I'm going to tell everyone to not buy Comcast.
Right. Well,
so
think
don't.
Of it this way. If you're in China, let's imagine that we live in China, they could be opening up our packets and changing words in the web pages. So if you go to a web page that tells you how to overthrow the Chinese government, now all of a sudden they're modifying it on the fly and changing it so you don't know how to overthrow the Chinese government.
Right. There's definitely a little bit of... Big Brother kind of scariness.
Yeah, you could take it to the extreme and, you know, let's say our government wants to put some sort of restrictions on the internet. Now with technology like this, they can do it on the fly and we really wouldn't even know because they could do it in such a way that it's not some huge overlaid banner ad. They could just randomly change words or pictures.
Yeah. On the other hand, like, maybe there's just really no other way to get people's attention that have this, because if they do have some computer on... Or
disconnect
some,
their service.
Well, they could do that, I guess.
If you are infected and you are sending out malicious data, you should be considered a hacker and your service disconnected. Or
yeah.
at least suspended,
yeah.
and they call you.
Well, I don't know why they just don't send out a service technician to come fix your damn computer.
Right.
My guess is that they just have a lot of infected computers on their network.
Oh, I can only imagine. Well, you remember, you know, a couple years ago, the study that was done, you put an un-antivirus, un-firewalled machine on a open cable modem, not behind a router, and it's hacked in 5 minutes. You know, literally
wow.
5 minutes. So,
crazy.
Yeah. So I agree with you. I like that they're taking action to tell people. I don't like the way they're doing it, but if it gets people to, you know, update their antivirus and actually get rid of malicious software, okay, I'll deal with it for now.
Yeah.
So here is a really, really cool thing. We all remember back maybe a year ago, whenever the HD DVD encryption key was released. And that was the coolest thing in the world because now people could back up their HD DVDs. And for the longest time, that is pretty much why Blu-ray won, because their encryption was considered unbreakable. You know, their whole system, you just couldn't hack it. And one of the reasons for that is because of HDCP. And that is the protocol that says you need a verified player using a verified transport, like an HDMI cable, to a verified device, like your TV. And it verifies that that digital signal is uninterrupted the entire way or your picture doesn't show.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the cool encryption that made Blu-ray win. It's awesome. Been broken. About a week ago, the master key was published. People didn't know whether it was real or not, but it's now been verified. The HDCP master key is out in the open for anybody. So what does this mean for normal people? Nothing. But for some people, this means that you can make your own Blu-ray player. It means you can play Blu-rays on Mac and Linux now because you don't need verified software. It means the analog loophole is back open, so you can record your Blu-rays onto VHS tapes if you have the technical know-how.
One second there. You can't play. You still can't play Blu-rays on Apple.
Well, without the drives.
Yeah, they don't make a Blu-ray drive yet.
Well, yeah. We'll buy a USB Blu-ray drive. Thanks for that little jab, Ryan. That's right in the heart there.
Yeah, no, I'm just kidding.
But what do you think about this? Do you think this is going to be a big deal sometime soon?
Well, I mean, it was pretty big when they cracked DVD way back, you know.
With CSS.
Right. And allowed people to play DVDs on Linux machines.
On computers in general, kind of. You know, you could back them up to ISO files and you could play them from your hard drive.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, but you could still play DVD. You still needed, like, software that had, like, the DCSS in it or whatever.
Right,
but,
right.
Or not DCSS. That was the stuff. That was the hacked CSS.
Something to read CSS.
Yeah, something to decrypt it. But it's, you know, I think it's interesting. The one I've had problems with this myself when I first got my laptop. It was last year, and I installed Windows 7 on it, and it has a Blu-ray player, and I got a Blu-ray software, and the beta driver that ATI had released didn't support the HDCP stuff correctly, so I couldn't watch Blu-rays.
So what did it do? Did it like pop up a message and tell you HDCP was the problem?
It was weird. Like sometimes it would work, and then it would like go to a gray screen, and then sometimes it would just do some really strange things. I got an update, and my computer has an HDMI port on it, and I hooked up to my LCD, my 40-inch LCD TV to watch something, and it wouldn't work either. So there was definitely like bugs with it, you know. So hopefully they'll be able to circumvent all this crap, and we can watch our Blu-rays however we want. Like, I mean, I don't even have like one DVD in my collection that's a copied DVD.
Right.
I think they're like overly concerned about pirating.
Yeah, I mean, really, I know a lot of people who have copy DVDs, but the reason they have copy DVDs is to store them all on their hard drive so they don't have to worry about going and finding their legitimately purchased copies of the DVD to watch something.
Or once the disc just decides to rot out and not work anymore.
You know, they have them on their media center. So they bought it. They have the original, but they just want it stored on a computer so it's easier to access. So I think this is going to allow people what they've wanted for a long time. You know, let us watch what we want, when we want it, how we want it.
Yeah.
So,
bitch.
Yeah. So I'm looking for some big things from companies now that HDCP has been cracked. Now, here is something for people with Android phones. Some Google Android apps have been found to be sharing data without telling you. Now, is this a big deal to you? I know you don't have an Android phone, but
it is. I mean, it depends on the data. Like, I see these things come out all the time, and it's like, oh, it shares like usage information with people. I don't really care so much about that if it's anonymized or whatever.
Well, here's some of the information that some things were sending: IMEI numbers, which is your basically your serial number for your phone, so things can now be tracked back to you. SIM card serial numbers. Phone numbers from your address book. It's like, this isn't just, you know, usage data. This is location information. You know, this is real data that points to you. So
I think I saw something similar about the IMEI numbers on the iPhone being shared out a couple days ago.
Really? I didn't see that.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's in my list to talk about next week, but yeah, I didn't see that yet. But that's a big deal. If your app starts sharing information that, you know, is that low level, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. It's probably not a good idea to allow the programs in to do that, but I don't know how you can really prevent it either.
Yeah, I mean, other than, you know, we've said this many times on many shows, don't install apps from companies you don't know. You know, just because it says in the description it's the coolest fart app, you shouldn't download and install it.
Never.
Because it's probably the coolest fart app that sends all of your financial information to hackers. But yeah, so if you use an Android phone, you know, be careful. if you do have one and you have a lot of apps, go back through your apps. You know, look through the list of your apps, see what permissions they have, and just make sure you're not giving permissions to apps from companies that you don't really trust or never heard of before. So that's all I want to say about that. I just wanted to get that out there. And our last security story of the day is something I brought up to you, Ryan, about a week ago. And that is, this article is from InfoWorld. You can no longer rely on encryption to protect a BlackBerry. From what this article says, the encryption on BlackBerry phones has been broken. Your thoughts?
This is sensationalism at its best. From what I've read here and at other websites, they did break the encryption on BlackBerry backup files. So anyone that has a BlackBerry knows that if they use the BlackBerry Desktop Manager, they can make a backup of their BlackBerry, and it makes an encrypted file on their hard drive. And I actually read that the data is actually decrypted as it goes out over the USB cable. So on the USB cable, it's in the clear, and then it gets stored as it comes into the BlackBerry application. It's re-encrypted and then put on the hard drive in a file. Now, the encryption that they use for the file is very different from the BlackBerry itself and the BlackBerry transport protocol, like, you know, on their network.
Right.
And I guess the sort of the weak spot is that they used a particular algorithm and only did a one-pass encryption, where the standard for using that is several tens of passes. And even like in the iPhone's case, which I think the iPhone uses this particular type of encryption for its whole, like,
for everything,
they do 1,000 passes. That said, it's not in any way related to the encryption that it may use similar features, but the encryption on the phone, if you encrypt your BlackBerry, first of all, and then also across the network, is completely different.
Yeah, so they say that BlackBerry, the backups will use either AES or TripleDes for the encryption, which is good so far. But they also say, you know, exactly what you just said, whereas the iPhone does 10,000 passes on their encryption, BlackBerry only does one on their backup files. So yeah, one pass on, especially TripleDes, you know, AES, fine, AES kind of has been cracked, the older versions, but TripleDes, I believe that's, people have known how to break that for a while. So I don't know how the software chooses which one to use, because this article just says one or the other.
Well, that they're saying there, the data transmitted between a BlackBerry Enterprise server and a BlackBerry smartphone is encrypted with a highly secure AES or TripleDes algorithm. So that's how they do the encryption between that. But I think the backup is different. The backup uses a different...
So the next page talks about the backup. Backup encryption uses AES with 256-bit. And the key derivation function, PBKDF2, is used only one time.
Yeah, that's the difference. So I guess in the case of the iPhone, where they use, like, do 1,000 iterations using that same feature, that's their only way to encrypt, so they really strengthened it. Or for BlackBerry, they're only using this method for the backup file. So
you don't see this as a big deal, since it's just the backup file.
I don't, because you would need access to the system to get to the data. So, like, plus you'd have to know that system backed up that BlackBerry. Like, it had to be a very specific attack.
Well, here's a question I have for you, just because I don't know how BlackBerries work. Now, let's say you have a BlackBerry from your company and they use BlackBerry Enterprise Server to manage it. BlackBerry doesn't allow you to store your own BlackBerry Enterprise Server. You can have... That's not true the way I stated it. Your data goes to BlackBerry servers in Canada and then gets transmitted back to your company's BlackBerry server.
Okay.
So whereas...
Well, yeah, it has to go through the cell network.
Yes. Well, I mean, whereas other things like Verizon and their IntelliSync software, your phone is configured to go straight to your company. It doesn't go through Verizon servers.
Okay.
It is phoned to your company. Whereas BlackBerry goes from your phone to BlackBerry and then to your company. Does the BlackBerry, the actual BlackBerry servers, do they have a copy of your backup too? Or does that just
I don't think it's the same thing. I think this is specifically talking about the IPD files that you make with the BlackBerry desktop
software. So just that software.
Yeah, I'm 90% sure. Yeah. Maybe I'll do some research on this.
I was worried about is that if somebody just wanted to hack the BlackBerry server in Canada, if they found a way to get into their server and do a directory listing and there is 20 billion backup files, they now can decrypt them all and get people's data.
I don't even think, even if that happened, I don't even think that the data, even though it goes to Canada, the servers in Canada, RIM servers, I don't think it gets stored there.
That's my question. I didn't know how that worked.
BlackBerry has a transport called BIS or BISP or something. It's like it's their information services protocol. And it's sort of like a layer on top of like the cell network, okay, sort of like TCP/IP.
Right.
I think it's just like a transport layer for data, and I think that is what connects to their servers in Canada, and then it relays the connections back to the registered BlackBerry Enterprise servers. Okay. I think.
Okay.
Not positive.
Right. Yeah, I was just worried that your backup is being stored someplace other than where you think it is. And somebody could just attack one crucial point and get everything.
Yeah. And I think this is only a problem, even if they did store those files on the server, this is only a problem for people that use the BlackBerry backup feature of their phone, the over-the-air backup.
Right.
Which I know I don't. The only thing on my phone that I care about are the contacts, and I have that synced with Google. So I really don't keep much on my phone that I'd be really worried about, like, you know, my email's all stored somewhere else.
But passwords to your email that are saved on your phone and passwords to your websites and...
Well, yeah, but those are typically encrypted. So they're like encrypted in an encrypted file.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I think this is like really, really...
blown out of proportion.
Yeah. You know, it'd be like, if they like hacked into the BlackBerry network and were able to like... you know, live stream all BIS data on the internet.
Right.
Like then I'd be like, oh shit, but
got to get a new phone.
Yeah. This is not that big of a deal.
Yeah. So, let's move on to some other companies now. Our next two articles basically talk about the same thing, just different companies. And that is AT&T and Verizon sending out overpayment refunds to their customers. So I use AT&T, you use Verizon. Have either of us gotten overpayment refunds?
I have not.
I have not either.
No.
So, but apparently, one of these companies, and I am not sure, it is Verizon, I believe, was sued. I'm not positive that it's Verizon. Either Verizon or AT&T. One of them was sued.
AT&T was sued.
Okay, so AT&T was sued, and that's why they're giving money back. And Verizon stepped up and said, oh, crap, we don't want to be sued over the same thing. Let's start giving people their money back for the people who have overpaid. So I think this is really cool because the guy in this article from Herec.com, I've really never heard of the site, but it's some third-party blog site. And the guy posted a picture of his check from AT&T, and they gave him back $370.
Sweet.
Yeah, so that's awesome. But apparently, you know, they've been billing him $30 a month, $30 more a month, I think is what it said, for his data plan. But I've been checking my bill, and I have been paying what I'm supposed to be paying, so that's good.
Yeah.
I just wonder, you know, what people out there haven't noticed that they have been overcharged this much money.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think they're you know, honest mistakes that they're trying to rectify.
Right, right.
So I don't really feel any, like, you know, hatred towards either of them.
Yeah, there's definitely no malice, you know, right here. Especially since, you know, Verizon came out and just said, oh, crap, we should do this now.
Yeah.
You know, they realized that they might have had the same problem, and they found out that they did, and they took care of it. So that's definitely cool. It sucks that it took a lawsuit for AT&T to figure it out. But definitely good. So any of you, you know, using AT&T or Verizon and you have data plans, you know, check. Maybe you'll get a check in the mail with some extra money. That'd be really cool. I wish I would get that. So this next article from the Apple Insider is kind of interesting. Now, we've heard forever, oh, iPhone's coming to Verizon, you know, beginning of next year. You know, we both of us have said time and time again, not going to happen. We both think it's going to be, they're going to wait until LTE comes out before they drastically change how an iPhone is made. But Apple has been buying lots of chips from Qualcomm. Qualcomm is the biggest CDMA maker ever.
The only, I think.
Yeah. And what Apple Insider is guessing now is that the iPhone 5 is going to be CDMA. CDMA, EVDO, and other places are actually saying that it's going to be both CDMA and GSM. So it can work on, it's a world phone, basically.
Right.
It's like some of the BlackBerries are. It can work on any network. So what do you think about this, that, you know, on either story, that the iPhone 5 is just CDMA or that it's going to be a world phone and not LTE like we originally thought?
I'm skeptical that they wouldn't include LTE. Like, we're getting really close to the rollout for new hot phones to not have it. Like, you know, we were
And it is rolled out in beta. So yeah. There are working things out there.
Right. And they plan to have, you know, a lot of the big markets covered next year. And it would seem very short-sighted to not include it. You know, maybe they're still working out the bugs and the chipsets, the LTE chipsets. I just don't know. But I'm surprised. I am surprised that they would release. I have a theory that maybe it won't be an iPhone. It'll be something else entirely, like
some new device from Apple,
right? Like sort of a competing type phone. Like, I just have a feeling that they may, like, Apple has like this, like, always has a history of like sort of like tiering things, like. Oh, like maybe they'll keep the iPhone as like their like really prestigious phone, and then they'll have this like other like scaled down phone that like
right.
sort of like a MacBook Pro versus like a MacBook regular.
Just a regular MacBook or an Air that has less
features.
Maybe
it'll be like an iPhone Pro. Maybe it'll be like
that could be.
Maybe they're gonna sell the phone directly and it'll work on any network in the world.
Yeah, iPhone World.
Yeah, or something. But
yeah, they also say that it might be the iPad 2.
Well, so, that could be.
Yeah.
It seems a little I guess the iPad came out first, and it sort of is missing some key features that I think they would be smart to add, like the front-facing camera and stuff like that.
Yeah, and like we saw in an article that we talked about a month ago, you know, they have these things in their testing lab for many years, like 4 years before they release them. So probably when they designed the iPad, they didn't even think about a front-facing camera. But now when iPad 2 comes out, it's probably going to have all of the cool things that the iPhone 4 has now. But yeah, I agree with you. Definitely short-sighted, you know, because LTE seems like, you know, everybody's going to hop on the bandwagon, and that is going to be the, not protocol, but the cell phone service of the entire world.
Right.
So why would you not release your new phone with LTE? Yeah, I don't understand that, but we'll see.
Yep.
I mean, all of these rumors, you know, most of them have been proven wrong in the past every time that a new iPhone has come out, but we'll see once iPhone 5 comes out. Now, a very cool thing in the cell phone world is that cameras are getting up close to the megapixel rating of really good regular still cameras. So the cameras inside of cell phones are now, at least on some Android phones, up to 14 megapixels. How awesome is that?
I don't think it's awesome at all, and here's why. The sensors on these phones are so tiny.
I was just about to say...
To be quite honest, like, I don't know if everyone's probably familiar with, maybe they're not. The digital SLR world, there's two main sizes. There's actually three main sizes, but there's the full frame size, which is pretty rare. There's a couple cameras that have it. The Nikon 5D.
Really only one or two from each manufacturer.
Yeah, the 5D, the 1D from Canon.
The 1DS.
Oh, the 1DS.
Yeah, not
sorry.
The 1D.
Yeah, the 1DS. And then... on the Nikon side, there's the D700 and the D3 and the D3X. They're all full-frame sensors. And then they have the smaller frames, which Nikon calls DX, and I think, I don't remember what Canon calls it, EF or something. Their EFS is like their smaller...
The EF is their lens standards.
Oh, yeah. Well, so. There's an EFS, it's like only fits on the smaller...
Yeah, frame. Yeah, it's for certain frames.
They have a crop, they call it a crop frame, so there's a smaller frame. And like some of them are like, the smaller ones are going up, you know, around 12 megapixels now, 13, 14 megapixels. And you're getting, those are getting to the point where the vertical lines of resolution, the way it gets like smashed into a little like size, yeah, on the sensor.
The amount of light that can hit that small square, right, sensor.
And the wavelength of the light and everything. Like, I read an article that, you know, it was on Ken Rockwell's website. He's a big Canon and Nikon guy. He said that it's not worth them going much bigger because the sensor's too small. Like, there's, they're not only are you hitting the limitations of the sensor, you're hitting the limitations of the lens.
Right.
Cramming that much detail into, because it's a smaller lens.
Yeah, I mean, visible light, the photons of visible light are a set size. They're pretty big.
Right.
So, I mean, if you have a small sensor, you're not, you have a limit.
Yeah, there's a limit. And I think it, this is obviously even worse in a four-thirds sensor or a one of these little sensors on a phone or even the point and shoots. Once you get up to, you know, around 8 megapixels, it ain't going to make a lick of difference. Right. There's other ways to make bigger differences, like dynamic range and that sort of stuff. Like, most of these cameras are still using like 14-bit sensors or less. Like, some are 10 or 12-bit sensors. They really need to get that up higher to get more color gamut.
Yeah, and that was one thing that a lot of people complained about the iPhone 4 when it came out, that, oh, it's only a 5-megapixel camera. Why would you put such a small camera in phones whenever there's 8 megapixels out now on Android? And Apple basically said what you just said. They're like, look, we can only put so big of a sensor in the phone. If we make it any bigger, it's not going to make a difference. So we're sticking with something that is, you know, good for that size of sensor, and we'll try to improve the photon detection of the sensor to make it more sensitive and make it, you know, process light better instead of making your picture bigger.
Yeah, I'm like perfectly happy with, 8 megapixels on my point and shoot. And I mean, yeah, 12 megapixels is like pretty standard on most of the big DSLRs now.
Yeah, I mean, my DSLR is 21 megapixels and I honestly couldn't live without it now that I have it, just because of how I take pictures. Mm-hmm. But as far as my phone goes, 5 megapixels, fine. Like, I'm not doing professional photo shoots with my phone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for phones, it's just not, does not gonna matter.
Yeah, so I'm actually interested to see what they're going to do with the sensor. Because like you said, something's got to give. You know, they have to do something to make these sensors accept that big of a picture. Are they faking it? You know, are they doing interpolation to try to make a picture that big? How good are the pictures going to look? We'll see whenever the cameras with these 14 megapixel, whenever the phones with these 14 megapixel cameras come out. Now, here is a story for Android people that you might like and you might not. Personally, if I was an Android user, I would not like this. And it's from the Business 2.0 Press website. Adobe is going to launch Air on Android. So Android has had Flash for a while. Do you think they need Air?
I don't really. I have a hard time like commenting on this because I'm not a big user of Air. I don't know really. I've seen it and I've seen it get installed, but I don't really know what all it does.
Well, I mean, it's just a packaged executable format. You know, it's a virtual machine just like Java or anything like that. And the executables come in a single Air file, and you install it. It puts things in its right place, and it runs through that virtual machine. So it's kind of a quick and easy way to, you know, use applications.
Okay.
And it's kind of like Flash in the way you develop it and the way the applications look.
Well, if it goes the long way to pissing off Apple, then I'd say I'm all for it.
Yeah, I'm worried that this is going to be kind of like Flash in that, you know, Flash is kind of a battery hog and there are stability problems with it. And now you have on your phone, you're introducing another virtual machine type executable format. You know, I don't know what this is going to do to the stability of Android phones or the battery life of Android phones. So I'm interested to see this. Yeah, I really can't comment that much either because I don't have an Android phone.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very interested to see. The only Air application I use is TweetDeck for Twitter.
I had TweetDeck. I used to have TweetDeck. That's the one. I remember that app requiring me to install Adobe Air.
Yeah. So a lot of Twitter applications require that, but that's really it. Like, I don't know of any other applications that use Adobe Air. Mm. So, yeah, who knows? Now, here is an interesting article. I hope you read more about this than I did. The G2 from T-Mobile, the new Google G2, it contains an unexpected feature which allows them to overwrite your software. Cool or uncool?
I'd say uncool.
Kind of like sure, unsure. Yeah, it's... I don't know what to say about this. I mean, we talk about this stuff every week, about all of these features that come out, and do they share your data, or they allow them to download stuff to your phone? I don't know. I really don't even want to talk about this. I don't know why I put it in here. It's just something I wanted to point out, that another thing like this is happening.
Yeah, I mean, it says here that the hardware, it restricts what software a device owner might wish to install. I mean, I think they're...
Yeah, it's not cool.
No, especially, I think this is the one thing that I'm really worried about the Android, is like this just manufacturing, or the fracturing of the OS among manufacturers.
Right. Yeah, I mean, basically with this phone, what they're saying is that, say this phone comes with Maps, a map application. If you were to install your own version of Maps, like you downloaded the code, you edited it, and you installed it over top of the existing Maps application, the phone would reinstall the firmware and put your phone back to default. Like, that's what this does.
Yeah, that sucks.
And that's kind of one of the points of Android, is to make an open system that people could do stuff with. And now they're making it so, yeah, it's open, but if you change anything in that open system, we're going to fix it for you. So, I don't know. So far, it's only the T-Mobile G2 that does this. I hope no other phones get a chip or software that does this, but yeah, not cool, T-Mobile.
No, nope.
Not cool. And the last article of the day is the new Windows Phone 7 lineup has been released, and Microsoft has put out, with AT&T and T-Mobile, the phones that will be coming out whenever Windows 7 finally goes live. You know, they list the HTC Surround, the LG Quantum, and the Samsung Focus. And have you seen any demos or any videos of these phones?
I haven't seen any demos, but I have watched a couple videos. You know, nothing too spectacular, other, you know, nothing exclusive or anything, but
right.
I wondered if you happened to see the commercials. There's a couple commercials.
No, I haven't seen any commercials.
Yeah,
for it.
Engadget had a couple of the commercials from the launch. They will be on TV, but they're not yet.
Oh, okay.
They were at the launch event. They're like the first official Windows Phone 7 commercials. They're pretty interesting. I don't know. I'm still pretty excited about Windows Phone 7. I think what struck me about the release in this article, I don't know if it points it out or not, but they're not launching with any devices on Verizon.
Yeah, it's just AT&T. AT&T has 3 phones, and T-Mobile has 2 phones.
Yeah, and then there's some like other, I think, international partners maybe that they have stuff. But I think it's a mistake. I don't know why Verizon isn't releasing.
Yeah, because I mean, if you would think about it the way we've always thought of phones, at least in the past couple of years, it's that AT&T gets nothing pretty much because they're exclusive with the iPhone. You know, so you would have expected Verizon to get these phones before AT&T would.
Yeah, I wonder if they're still brokering out some kind of deal, or, you know, who knows.
Yeah, that's interesting. But looking at the specs of some of these phones, you know, the LG Quantum is DLNA enabled, so you can, you know, stream stuff to your TV. 16 gigabytes of onboard storage. The Samsung Focus is only 9.9 millimeters thick with a Super AMOLED screen. So a lot of these phones have some really cool features, and I'm definitely looking forward to, you know, walking into the AT&T store or the T-Mobile store and touching one of these.
Yeah,
actually being able to play with it.
I really would like to play with one too. I also saw they announced that they're gonna roll out copy and paste in early 2011.
I saw an article made fun of them. They're like, Microsoft wants Windows 7 or Windows Phone 7 to be just as popular as the iPhone, so they're not shipping it with copy and paste.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at least they're giving it to you in the first year. It took Apple like 4 years to wise up to that.
That is true.
Well, not four, but
I find it funny, but I think, really? Like, come on. I mean, they saw how big of a deal this was with iPhones. Why would you not put this in your phone OS.
Well, I think the problem comes starts or is trying to do copy and paste on a touchscreen display. That's the challenge. How do you do it? How do you implement it? How do you get it to work? And
copy Apple.
Well,
I mean, they've done it. So if you're really struggling, take hints from them, because they stole stuff from everybody else when they made their phone, you know?
Yeah.
That's how patents work. You just steal stuff and somebody sues you and you say no.
You pay it or you pay the price.
Right, you pay the price or you say, no, that doesn't infringe. We'll take you to court.
Yeah,
so I'm interested. I like that there are so many, you know, 5 phones coming out. And like you said, you know, the international customers that have new phones. But I'm hoping it's not a bomb. I'm hoping it's not another Palm Pre.
Yeah.
We have yet to see.
I think there's more. I think they have more market leverage than Palm Pre did, for sure.
Oh, definitely. I mean, they're Microsoft.
Yeah. I mean, the integration with the Zune software and all of that, they might have a winner out of the box with it. I'm going to give it a shot. You know, I'll check it out.
It all depends on how easy it is to use, you know, because the OS is definitely, I don't want to say revolutionary, but it's completely different from any other phone OS.
Yeah.
So
I'm actually trying to hold off on deciding on a phone for several reasons. You know, I'm able to upgrade my phone now on Verizon, but I'd like to hold off as long as I can, because I'm thinking LTE is going to come out, and I'd like to see Windows Phone 7 at least try it before I decide. Right. Maybe get some, you know, see what people think about it after they've had it a while.
Yeah, and so most likely none of these phones, the Windows Phone 7s, are going... That is so stupid to say. The Windows 7 phones are not going to have LTE, you know, so you're going to have to wait for another round if you want to get Windows Phone 7
unless
with LTE.
Maybe that's why Verizon's holding out.
That could be.
They want to launch their Windows... Maybe they're going to launch it as like a top-tier type phone.
That could be.
You know?
Yeah, who knows? We have yet to see. But definitely, you know, if you're in the market for a new phone, if your contract's expiring or you have your upgrade status coming up, give it a couple months, a month or two, and go check out the Windows Phone 7s. Hopefully Microsoft hit one out of the park with this. But that is it for this week's episode of the Slongcast. As usual, if you want us to talk about a story, you find something interesting, you want us to go over, bookmark it on Delicious as Slongcast 017. For next week's episode, episode 17. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. You can find Ryan on Facebook and Twitter. His username is Ryan Lancey. And have a wonderful, wonderful Wednesday evening.